6 or 4 p.m.
We'll read it in the paper.
We were right in the midst of a presentation by Mr. Alper, and he will come back. Today is Monday, March 7, 2016. Good evening, welcome back, and let the record show that the House Resources Committee will be convened at 6:02 p.m. President Representative Josephson, Representative Heron, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative Olson, my fellow co-chair, Representative Tara Ricker, myself, Representative Johnson is present also, and Representative Harker has been excused. He was excused all day, so I didn't say that earlier. Let the record reflect, we have people here to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello, Martha from House Records. Hello to Matt from LIO. Welcome back to Department of Revenue Staff Director Ken Alford. Let's continue the presentation on House Bill 247. I believe we're on slide number 48. Mr. Alford, please slow down in presenting. We have to finish, and thank you in advance for naming. Did I just write that? presenting.
Just take your time.
thank you in advance for naming the slide you are discussing with us. We'll stop at 7:30 p.m. this evening, and hopefully Mr. Apple can complete the presentation by that time. Then we'll start on the section analysis tomorrow. I believe we left off on section 18 back on February 12th. And Commissioner of Revenue is here, Randy. Commissioner Halfbeck, sorry, and he's in the back. Thank you for attending, sir. Okay, welcome back, Mr. Alper. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record, and thank you for having us back. My name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. With me is Dan Stickle, the Assistant Chief Economist at the Tax Division. When we left this afternoon, we were on slide 48. slides number 47 through 50, in many ways, paralleled slides number 43 through 46. They were all status quo slides looking at the assumptions of a new oil field being developed in Cook Inlet. The main difference, the only difference between the two, is what exactly happens in 2022 when the current tax caps are scheduled to sunset, to be self-repealed in existing law. So the first set of slides, which showed the taxes that would be paid under the underlying tax regime, 35% net profits tax, showed one set of answers. This is another set of answers looking at what would happen if the Cook Inlet caps were extended indefinitely. And thus, if you look at this slide, the $60 slide, you see zero production tax being paid because the statutory production tax on oil and Cook Inlet today is zero, which is based upon the conditions that were in place when PPT passed in the year 2006. Those are the old ELF multipliers. So you can see that in a zero tax scenario, it's quite robust for the producers, but at $60 oil, you see a negative state NPV. Negative $37 million. We do get money from royalty, we do have eventually positive cash flow, but not enough to compensate the state for the credit cost up front, especially without any back-end production tax revenue. So that's where we were on slide 48, in context 47 was the beginning of this conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, when we're talking about this slide here with the total annual losses, the middle section in the life cycle table down there, that's including all royalty and all property tax, not the state's portion that it comes to the general fund. In other words, 25% of a minimum of 25% of the royalty has to go to the permanent fund, so that's not available for the general fund. And the property tax split about half in Cook Inlet. Is that correct? So,
through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'm going to answer what I believe it to be, and then I'm going to ask Ms. Niehaus, who's on the line, to confirm just to make certain. What I believe these numbers include is the non-permanent fund share of the royalty, meaning the general fund portion of royalty, 75%. And I'm fairly certain that it includes only the state's portion of property taxes, meaning the portion that's shared with municipalities is not included in this analysis. So this is the state's unrestricted general fund cash flow as an isolated data set. Sherry, are you there?
Yes, I'm here through the chair, Representative Seaton. I believe that actually the state revenue in this case does include the amount that would go to the permanent fund. There was no, I believe if we were only representing the revenue that goes to the general fund, it would be called GFUR, General Fund Unrestricted Revenues. So my understanding is this is state revenues only, so it would not include the amount that would go to the municipality for the property tax, but it does include the amount that would go to the permanent fund.
And
go ahead,
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, maybe we can get that verified and get back to us on that, just so that we're understanding exactly what it has in the end. But that's fine for now.
Yeah. Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Seaton, and part of the confusion, and thank you, Sherry, for correcting me, is we did the analysis both ways for Representative Seaton's request. We had a broader set of analysis that with different cash flows that he asked for, so I wasn't sure which one survived to this version that we're doing for the committee. So with all that in mind, I'm about to step forward to slide number 49, which is the $80 oil scenario. Once again, there is no production tax. There's the royalty. The state is now with a positive number, $63 million. Quite possibly, if you're looking at general fund only, that might go back to being a negative number. We'd have to find that out. And then the producer's cash flow discounted is relatively robust at $612 million is the value of their discounted cash flow. Generally speaking, there's not a lot of difference in the shapes of the curves for 47 versus 8 versus 9. It's just a matter of the magnitude of them tied to the different prices of oil.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alper, when I look at these sheets, my eyes continually focus on the your comparison with the opportunity lost, I guess, which is what you're trying to reflect in the state NPV, 6.15%. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when you say state NPV 6.15%, yes, it's the value of the what we call a discounted cash flow. A dollar received to next year is 6.15% less valuable than a dollar we receive this year. A dollar received 2 years from now would be 6.15% times 6.15% less valuable. So the deeper you get into the future, the less the money is worth to us. That's right. That's the nature of that.
Follow up, if I may. So to compare, to set that the NPV aside and compare an apple to an apple, it would be $337 million on this slide to $1.4 billion about, right? $1.385 billion. Those would be that'd be the comparison.
If the cash flow, the money in, money out, without worrying about time. Our $337 million compares with the producer's $1.385 billion.
Yep.
Right.
Okay.
And in terms of the time value of money, our 63 compares to their 612.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on, as in all of these models, it seems the forecast price falls somewhere in between the $60 and the $80 number. So the state's NPV is almost exactly zero, $14 million, with a data set this large is essentially a rounding error, and the producer's positive value of $481 million. Now this is, as I said earlier, a relatively unlikely scenario of the status quo. It presumes that the legislature chooses to indefinitely extend the existing caps on Cook Inlet taxes without making any other changes to the tax and credit regime in Cook Inlet.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on that again?
Go ahead.
Thank you. When we recessed at 3:15 or so, I asked you about that, and you said it's unlikely. Would their arguments, that is, it's unlikely that we would extend them beyond 2022, wouldn't the arguments we've heard be the same sort of arguments, short of having a gas line, you know, near the city gate coming down from the North Slope? In which case, we'd, I think we might logically say, what are we doing with Cook Inlet at this point? But why would the arguments be any different? Couldn't they be even more of what we heard? And I don't mean to suggest, I heard some things that were very compelling. But why would those arguments be different?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, to my knowledge, no one is actively asking for extension of the Cook Inlet tax caps right now. There are certainly many proponents to keeping the tax credit regime in place the way that it is. We heard that in public testimony and in invited testimony, last week, large amounts of it. Those were left in place for 15 years. That's a very long time. A production tax of zero is hard to justify over the long term, unless we simply didn't have a production tax. That would be a very different thing. We do have a production tax on the books that pays out a lot of credits, thus leaving us in, if you look at the red bars here, at the forecasted price, the state is spending $347 million on tax credits of various sorts to the owners of that field without any production tax. As a diligent sovereign, as an entity desiring to balance the budget and do all the many things that the Alaskan state government needs to do, I have a hard time imagining a justification for that over the indefinite long term.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move ahead now to the first slide that looks at the impact of House Bill 247. We're looking at now the $25 million per company cap, which is clearly apparent in the red bars in the upper left-hand corner. You could see the reimbursements right at that $25 million number for several years before they reduce and the state gets positive cash flow from the production tax. Even with that, at $40 oil, it's not really making a lot of money for anybody. But the taxes in question is enough to provide positive cash flow to the state, $159 million worth of production taxes, discounted cash flow of negative $19 million. Now, more interestingly, the state's total cash flow, including apparently permanent fund royalties, creates a positive net present value of $108 million. Keep in mind, just as one might say, and I made the argument a few minutes ago, that the maintain the tax caps forever scenario is too low, this tax regime for Cook Inlet is almost certainly too high. This is a 35% net profits tax without any sort of comparable benefit like the per barrel credit that exists on the North Slope, without any sort of new oil GVR type benefit that exists on the North Slope. So we have just the 35% net tax, and you're seeing with that, certainly the state has a positive present value, and once you add up the royalty, the producers are losing money at $40 oil. I'd like to skip ahead to slide number 52, which has the $60 scenario, and you could see now that even at $60 oil, even with this relatively onerous production tax regime and the cutting off of the credits at $25 million, this is actually a money-making field for the producers. They have a positive present value of $80 million. That's the bottom line there, the producer's cash flow. Meanwhile, the state has a value of $121 million discounted on the production tax or $331 million on the totality of state revenue. And once again, you can see here the quite clean cutoff at $25 million per year of the tax credits themselves. What I'm going to do, and I hate jumping around, and I'm going to pause while I do it, I just want to look at, so if you look at the state's numbers here, I'm going to write them down on a scrap of paper, 121 and 331, and the producers of 80, that's with SB 247 in place at $60, with the tax caps expiring. I'm going to go back eight slides to slide number 44, where you can see that the state gained about $170 million on the production tax, or about $170 million in present value, and the producers lost about $120 million in their cash flow in the changes envisioned by House Bill 247. That's the primarily from the moving the cash flow around of the $25 million per year cap on the refunded tax credits. So, and all this jumping around, I know it's confusing, and I'm going to stop doing it right now, because when we get to the end of the presentation, which I'm surprisingly close to, you'll see there are a couple of summary tables that bring all of this data on two slides, and we'll be able to review all of it at the same time. So I'm jumping back ahead the eight slides that I was on slide number 52, which was the tax caps expiring, $60 scenario. I'm moving ahead now to the $80 oil. Tax caps expiring at 80, slide number 53, and seeing how the state gets a pretty robust cash flow from the production tax now, that high production tax. The state gets an excellent cash flow from the from their total take, and the producers are seeing a value also of $278 million in discounted value. So that's certainly, as the price of oil gets higher, of course, everyone does better across the board. And to be clear here, our cost profiles and all of the other assumptions stay the same as the price of oil moves around. So we're purely seeing the impact of the changes in the price of oil.
Mr. Chair, I'm used to being in a queue, but because there isn't one, I'll just get in the head of the line, if I may. Through the chair, Mr. Alper, are you saying that future legislator, whatever that is, the 33rd legislature or something, I don't know, would need to revisit, obviously, this tax before 2022 or in 2022, that with the expiration of it, if 247 were to pass, those are a couple serious caveats, that this arguably is too favorable to the state? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Before you answer, would you address the chair when you have a question?
Yes.
Please?
Yes, I think.
Go ahead, sir.
Certainly. And through the chair, Representative Josephson, the expiration of the tax caps in 2022 is a pending issue before the legislature, with or without the passage of tax credit reform this year. My opinion is only worth what my opinion is worth, but yes, I believe that production tax is likely too generous and frankly unstable for Cook Inlet, given its constraints, and that price, that tax system remains, would be the same tax system for gas as well, 35% of net profits without any offsets or per barrel credits or anything of the like. That's not, it wasn't so much left there to be the tax system, it was left there because the previous legislature, when looking to reform North Slope taxes, didn't need to worry about it yet because it was enough years off in the future. It was sort of kicked down the can for it. The can is kicked down the road for a future day. We are getting a little bit closer to that day, but we're still, you know, here we are in the tail end of the 29th legislature. This is a problem that, yeah, you're correct, might not need to be addressed until the 32nd legislature in the 2021 session. But what Mr. Meyer testified to, and I'm inclined to agree with him, is that industry finds instability in our system in a couple of different places. First off, of course, that we have big, giant deficits, and therefore they don't know what our government's going to look like in a year or two. Secondly, and more importantly in the context here, they see our extensive negative cash flow from the tax credit system. We're spending hundreds of millions of dollars that are more than the amount of production tax revenue coming in, and they are presuming on a certain level at least that some sort of reform is going to be made, and they're building that into their assumptions, that instability. And the third instability is the sunsetting of the tax caps. They don't know what the fiscal system is going to be for the majority of the life cycle of any decision that they might make now. If any investment decision made now or soon is a multi-year decision, and they don't know what the tax is going to be for the tail end of it. So if it were possible, if we had the time and the inclination, I would be happy to work with the committee to create a new Cook Inlet oil and gas tax system. It might be beyond the scope of this committee's interest in this session's capacity for new heavy lifting in the field of oil and gas, but I leave that to you and to the rest of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that's the $80 tax caps expiring scenario on slide 53. Slide 54, with the forecast prices again going up from $50 now, $56 next year, up into the 70s and stabilizing into the 70s without considering inflation, we see the state with positives on the production tax, higher positives on the overall take, and the producers with a positive value, $183 million on the field. When you can, these fields, it's interesting to see their cash flows. They drop off quite rapidly once you get past peak production, and that's just because of the nature of any large oil field. And these peak at 17,000 barrels a day of production, but it declines rapidly after that peak. So slide number 55, this is the tax caps extended with the impact of House Bill 247. So you can see now, instead of the bigger spike of negative credit cash flow that we saw 8 slides earlier, we see the capped at the $25 million per year, and the sum total is $142 million worth of tax credits going out the door. The other main change, which I should have mentioned a few minutes ago, through the passage of House Bill 247, is of course the repeal of the Cook Inlet well lease expenditure and qualified capital expenditure credit. So what we're really seeing here is the state's only paying 25% of costs through the development phase, through the net operating loss credit, as opposed to the 50 to 60% that we're currently paying. So that cuts the state's cash obligations more than in half, which tremendously helps the state's bottom line. Even with that, at $40 a barrel, we're losing money, of course, on the production tax, because there is no production tax, and we're barely making money on the total state take. The producer portion of it is also losing money, as they were with status quo. I mean, interestingly, the difference in these numbers, and we'll see them in the final, are about the same between the two scenarios of tax system, the no tax and the underlying tax, as there is between the before and the after with the passage of this bill. You know, the order of magnitude, it's about the same, and we'll see that when we get to the summary slides. Moving on to slide 56, this is closer to a break-even price for everyone, $60 oil. At $60 oil, we're now paying $134 million in credits, so with a negative discounted value of negative $97 million, but the state gets a decent return on the rest of the take, so therefore we have $126 million in total state take, and a larger number for the producers. They're doing better at $214 million, and as far as value to the company. I'm going to move quickly to 57 and see the same kind of numbers, and it's unfortunate that the scale jumps. I'm going to quick go back from 56 to 57. Look quickly at the upper right-hand corner. It looks like the numbers just got smaller, but that's because the top of this chart on slide 56 is at $50 million, but the top of the chart on slide 57 is $100 million. So, in fact, this total state take is coming in at close to $80 million a year in the peak years of the project. And at $80 oil, the total state take discounted value is $225 million. We're still, of course, in a negative number. If the tax caps are extended, the production tax is never going to be a positive number, of course. If we spend any money on credits 1 year, that becomes a negative money for the entirety of the calculation, because there's never a positive number to offset against. And then, of course, the producers at $496 million in cash flow, that's their discounted price at $80 oil, which people are waiting for. At the forecasted price, again, the state does pretty well, the producers do better. With the tax caps extended, that's a very generous regime to industry. And what I'd really like to do, having put all this exotic graphics before you, is to go to the summary slides 59 and 60. 60 and 61. What we have on slide 60 here is all of the scenarios from the North Slope on a single piece of paper, which might make it easier to have a conversation. And then the subsequent slide, 61, will be the Cook Inlet summary. So what do we have before us here? I showed 20 different scenarios, 20 different slides with North Slope modeling. The first 8 were based on the idea of a smaller field, a 50 million barrel field. And you can see as you look down this chart, you have the status quo at the 4 different oil prices, and then the House Bill 247 scenarios at the 4 different oil prices. And you can see each of the metrics that we were looking at, the major metrics anyway, in the summary corner of each slide, the total credits paid, the net of production tax credits minus eventual taxation, and then the discounted value of that cash flow. The same analysis done for total state take, total net gain and net present value, and then finally the producer's cash flow, positive or negative, and then their discounted value. And the one thing you can see across the board, which I alluded to several times, for the producers, all of the $40 scenarios are losers for them, no matter what. The $60 scenarios are winners for the smaller field, or even with the changes envisioned by House Bill 247. The changes made by 247 do turn the large field from a small gain to a loss, with the main reason for that being the much larger comparable benefit of the cap of $25 million a year on how much credits we're prepared to purchase. That's a much bigger deal for a much bigger field. So you see that there on the right. The 12 scenarios that we did for the larger oil field, the 750 million barrel field, are there because we have two different so-called after scenarios. One of them where the companies get the $25 million, and the second set, the last four scenarios on this page, are the circumstance where a very large company with more than $10 billion in revenue would be completely excluded from being able to get state cash rebates. But interestingly there, if you just look over to the right at the, say, the producer impact, at $80 oil, at the $7.50 there they are at $22.16, and that's the number, I'll sort of shine it at the wall there. That's the producer's net present value at $80 oil of the status quo. That drops to $1.4 billion if they get $25 million a year from us, but only by another $60 million less than that for getting none. So there's far more impact done from the reduction to the $25 million than there is the further reduction to the zero. So I might have been wise to start with these slides rather than finish with them, because they take a lot of information and boil it down to put it on a single paper. I think this does a good job of laying out all of the work that we did in trying to look at different scenarios, and once again we're prepared to do any others that the committee might request. If there aren't questions on 60, I'm going to jump ahead to 61. Now 61 has 16 scenarios. We only looked at the smaller field because we don't anticipate elephant fields in Cook Inlet, but we're looking at the two different tax regimes. With the third column, where the question is, do the tax cap sunset, yes and no, you could see the impact in both state take and in producer take from those different scenarios. So here we are with, for example, at $80 oil, the status quo with the tax cap sunsetting, the producer's present value drops from 396 to 278. They lose about $118 million in present value, presuming that the tax cap sunset. If the tax caps are extended, they're losing about 120. So similar numbers, but the increment between the tax cap sunsetting and not within the status quo is actually bigger. It's over $200 million benefit to the company of extending the tax caps within the status quo, mm-hmm. and over $200 million benefit from the company from extending the tax caps within the HB 247 scenario. So I guess the argument that I'm making with that is the credit changes, while material, are smaller in magnitude than any other decisions that this or a future legislature will make about the tax regime itself that impacts production in Cook Inlet. Another thing I want to mention, after our hearing, I spoke to the people who were working on the modeling, the sheriff who's on the phone. We would like to put together some gas field life cycle modeling. We think we could do it in fairly short order. We can provide slides to the committee. We don't need to be scheduled again. Now that you're all more or less familiar with the format, you don't need me necessarily sitting here walking you through it, but we're happy to provide some extra slides to look at that. And then Representative Olson asked me after the hearing if we had other scenarios. One thing we've done on the North Slope side is look at, for the large field, the 750 million barrel field, what would the impact be if we had, if it were in a high royalty location, if it were in a part of the state where they were paying the 1/6 rather than the 1/8 royalty. And with that higher royalty, although we gain money on the royalty side, we do lose money on the production tax side because of the way Senate Bill 21 is constructed, that the gross value reduction, the so-called new oil benefit, increases from a 20% benefit to a 30% benefit if the entirety of a field is at the high royalty level. So the bottom line numbers are about the same, frankly, but we'll provide the slides with the, although it's more royalty and less production tax. And
Representative Wilson.
Ken, can you do a table similar to the summary table on Cook Inlet for the interior, for Middle Earth, everything that we have going on in Fairbanks, with basically the same columns?
And through the chair, Representative Olson, yes. I'm saying yes before I check with our staff, so I'm pretty sure yes. The Middle Earth has its own statutory tax caps that I believe are good until 2027. So we have a little bit more certainty for the short and medium term as to what the tax is going to be. They are locked in at 4% of gross value through, I believe, 2027. So we should be able to do that. The template field, if there is such a thing, is what Doran is talking about developing in the Manana area, I would imagine. If that's acceptable to you, Representative Olson, then we would be happy to do some modeling of that.
Hello? I assume we have tax credits for the Fairbanks LNG storage facility. maybe include that. How about the in-state refinery up north?
Yeah, these, through the chair, Representative Olson, these are hard credits to build into project level modeling. The Fairbanks utility, the Fairbanks regional project, is going to benefit from the storage tank credit. That's a comparable credit to what was received by CINSA in the Cook Inlet storage. But I don't know where the refinery credits can be built into that. I don't know enough about the local utilities and needs as to where that might play into the project itself. But if you'd like to talk to us about that afterwards, I'm to help guide the direction as to how to run this modeling.
Hello?
I'm fine up.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page. That's why I asked the question. But and when they expire. Thanks. I know it's a lot of work, but I think it'll all help us get our hands around it.
Through the chair, Representative Olson, not that I want to, your reading assignment, we did three long presentations to the Senate Working Group in the fall, one of them dedicated to Cook Inlet, one of them to North Slope, and one dedicated to Middle Earth credits. Those give a pretty good overview of how they're structured, how they've been used, what the benefits are, what the sunsets are. So I'll send you, when I get back to the office, the links to all of those, and then just so you can go through that, your wish as a background document, and then we'll do some modeling on a theoretical future project.
Well, perhaps if they could go to the chairs and not me.
Without question, Representative Olson.
Thank you,
the chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Following up on Representative Olson's modeling, can you also make sure that we get some that are private royalty or on private land where and what we're providing? There are differences in taxes and minimum taxes and those kind of things as well. So, but I think it'd be very helpful to us to know what our cash flow is on those where we don't receive any royalty.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, we provided to the committee earlier, might have been today, a copy of an analysis we did for a member of the other body, just showing what are the royalty breakdowns for different categories of land. Federal land in NPRA, federal land in NAMLA, different what private royalty looks like and all of that. So that will be shared with the committee soon. We would like to run some scenarios. I believe I mentioned it. Doran's first project works out great because it's on state land, but their second project, which is on their own private land, would have a very different cash flow to the state, and it's worth looking at those. We might not get into the multiple variations and different price scenarios, but maybe a few less options for each possible scenario. I don't want to inundate the committee with another 50 slides, but I think that would be very helpful to provide that sort of modeling, and we will do so. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that we frequently hear sort of, you know, in evaluating these different tax structures is not having winners and losers and sort of things, you know, that favor one company size over another or development opportunity. And so it's just more kind of a generic question, but this 247 kind of moves away from some of the other credits to net operating loss sort of structurally, but keeps 35% for North Slope and 25% for Cook Inlet. And I just wonder if there's reasoning beyond what I may be thinking as to why that stayed like that, and if you considered doing the same for both areas at any point, and why that would, you know, be good or bad.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the 35% operating loss credit on the North Slope came along for the ride with the 35% base tax rate in Senate Bill 21. Mm-hmm. That change was only applied to the North Slope. However, the portion of the tax code that talks about the base rate didn't parse it out. It actually put that 35 number in statute. That's why we have this 35% tax credit, tax rate in Cook Inlet. It would certainly be possible to put in a 35% operating loss credit without a terribly complicated amendment that would increase the state's cost, the state's liability. A part of the rationale for the higher operating loss credit on the North Slope is that the companies actually are paying those taxes. So there's some measure of a playing field leveler in play here. With you use the example of a major producer. If a major producer spends one more dollar on some new field, they reduce their taxable income, and therefore they save 35 cents on their taxes. Regardless of the per barrel credit, they do get the tax savings is at the marginal rate of 35%, so we offer a 35% operating loss credit to the new guy, to the person who doesn't have profits. Up until such time as the incumbent producer in Cook Inlet is actually paying taxes, there isn't really a playing field to level. We don't need to give a higher benefit to the person on their loss credits to make them equitable with the person with the taxpayer if the taxpayer's effective rate is zero for the next 5 years. But at such time as there is a new Cook Inlet tax regime, it seems to me that a new Cook Inlet operating loss credit would be an important component of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Alpert. Of course, the other factor following up on Representative Tarr's question is the whole issue of our need for natural gas in South Central. And that's more parity with the North Slope.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is an excellent point. Certainly there remains, although not as overwhelming or as imminent as it might have been a few years ago, some sense of gas anxiety, supply anxiety for the Cook Inlet utilities. You heard that from them. If we need to provide a higher level of benefit to keep that gas being produced, especially in a world where we are proposing eliminating the drilling credits, it's a reasonable argument to say that 35% as a sort of a compromise number going forward might be viable. Now, we're not certainly proposing that, and I'm not in a position to offer that, but while going from 50, 60 to 25, going to 35 might certainly blunt the impact.
Member Jane Wilson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, have you done any models on the Agrium bill and the impact of the potential impact of the credit that's built within it?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, I appreciate your asking that. I did write the Department of Revenue's fiscal note for that bill and the bill analysis for the governor. I'm fairly familiar with the provisions and the economics embedded in that bill. It's an interesting concept, and it has a lot of upside for the state without that much downside, simply because there's no upfront cash expended. It's very different as envisioned to any of the tax credits that we're looking to reform here, and that it would require the producer, Agrium, to do all the work and make the commitment to redevelop their facility and then begin purchasing large amounts of gas and then earn a profit and start having a corporate income tax obligation. And then any credit they earned through House Bill 100 would be an offset against their corporate income tax liability. And what that bill could do potentially is provide the security for gas suppliers to go and drill and develop new fields that would, for example, we use the example of Fury. Fury is a, they may have made a large discovery. We really don't know. There's been conflicting information in the press. They've signed some relatively small sales contracts. But if, in fact, they're sitting on a large resource, they would like to be able to develop it, but they're not going to do that unless they have a way to sell it. Something like a rebuilt Agrium facility might go a long way towards giving them the security they need to do that. And in that case, it would, frankly, make it easier to come in and modify some of the Cook Inlet tax credits because there would be a lot less supply anxiety going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that something the administration might support?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, I'm not in a position to speak for the administration. I don't know if the governor has taken a position on House Bill 100. I did my best to analyze it and model it as dispassionately as I could and talk about the potential benefits. In some ways, it's a hard year without a tax credit bill. You know, we have negative cash flow to the state, we're losing money, big deficits, and we're here before you with a bill to reduce the state's spending on tax credits by several hundred million dollars. So it's hard to say, oh, but we want to add this other one. However, there's a lot of argument to be made for targeted, smaller, very focused credits, which have a really good multiplier for the state's economics.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Kind of getting back to the North Slope. I mean the Cook Inlet for a minute. You know, our consultants told us that $5 to $7 MCF was sufficient gas price to develop even the most expensive gas around the world. And so it seems that anything that we do with credits, of course, are oil and gas undifferentiated in Cook Inlet. So those credits aren't needed for gas production in almost every scenario. So if we continue to pay the credits in Cook Inlet and we're getting the multiple of what we got, the 8,000 barrels a day, or even if we go up and get twice that much, we're still in the annual credit range of $200 to $400 million. It's $68 to $136 per barrel is the effective amount that we're subsidizing for that. Even if some of the companies are drilling for gas, but the credits weren't needed to get that drilling. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how do we go through and separate oil from gas, or can we, with the combined drilling costs and combined capital costs equation that we have. Do we have any mechanism in front of us for doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the $136 figure, I just want to clarify where that came from, and that was the analysis that you did. And if you take the 8,000 barrels a day of increased oil production that we've seen in Cook Inlet in the last few years and divide that among the $400 million that we spent on credits last year, that works out to about $136 per incremental barrel over the course of the year. Obviously, that doesn't divide the benefit with the gas and all of that, but I mean, it's a very large number, but it's not, as large as it is, it's not outrageous because the numbers are real. We did spend $400 million. As for dividing costs between oil and gas, that's always a complicated one. It's one that I'm probably going to let Dan speak to in a minute because he's worked at the Department of Revenue longer than I have. One of the issues that was before the body when there was a decoupling bill, spent a lot of time in this committee in 2010, was how to adequately separate costs between oil and gas. It's easier when you're, and maybe the example in your district, the Blue Crest project, might be easier than most just because they've got a very different and distinct drilling location for their oil project versus their gas project, even though the resources themselves are in the same part of the earth, they're vertical above each other. But I think that's more the exception than the rule. So, Dan, can you speak to our ability to separate oil and gas expenditures?
Sure. Dan Stickle, Assistant Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue, and Representative Seaton through the chair. My understanding is currently, if you have a unit within Cook Inlet that would produce both oil and gas, that those commingled costs would be separated based on the gross value of point of production of the oil versus the gas. So if 60% of your value came from oil, then you'd attribute 60% of the costs to the oil. And that would, of course, be before calculating your tax that you'd apply the zero tax ceiling for oil to and the 17.7 cents per MCF ceiling for gas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'm trying to figure out if we've got a new field, all the investments up front, and the credits are earned up front, and production comes later, and that can vary by how much gas, how much oil. I mean, it's not like it's always a 50-50 cut or a 75-25 cut. So I'm trying to figure out, does that mean that if you were working on that kind of a scheme, you would go back and recover some credits from someone if they had more gas than oil, if you weren't giving credits for gas because the price is adequate to support a gas development? Or how I don't recall the conversation of how we got into it and Cook Inlet as far as decoupling.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the decoupling bill ended up with a formula tied to, I believe it was gross value at the point of production. So it was, it's artful and it's inexact, and it would be possible to a certain extent to do a more comprehensive separation, although it would be a workload within the department. I think the question you're really asking is, could we establish a different level of credit support for oil versus gas? And I think we could, although I'd definitely need to check with a few people over what some of the hurdles and pitfalls to that might be. Because ultimately, if you go back to the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, the desire was to get a big benefit to make sure people found enough gas to keep the lights on. And as it turns out from our own analysis, a third or so of that money got spent on oil. That might not have been necessary to get the oil developed because the oil was had a more stable market and it wasn't as much of a life or death situation. So if we wanted to do two different things for oil versus gas, we'd have to look at how to implement it, but I believe it could be done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else?
Just one comment. I think oil is an issue in parts of Cook Inlet, particularly to Tesoro, who used to get all their oil in Cook Inlet. Now they're bringing it around from Valdez or elsewhere because there is not an adequate supply.
Yeah. Anybody else? Thank you very much, Mr. Alper. Are there any other committee questions or comments? We'll stop for today, and we'll meet tomorrow at 1 p.m. to continue our work on House Bill 247. Thank you, Mr. Alper, and we'll see you tomorrow.
We got
45 minutes left.
We're adjourned at 6:51.